Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. It was George Bernard Shaw who said that England and America are two countries separated by a common language. What we have in common and what separates us goes further, however, than just a language. The Daily Wire is an American news website and media company that exercises a role in public commentary on behalf of the centre and the right of the political and philosophical spectrum in America that is undreamt of in the UK. Founded about 9 years ago, the Daily Wire's annual revenue now exceeds over $100 million, has 150 employees. The more prominent voices like Ben Shapiro and Matt Walsh, who famously produced a documentary exploring what a woman was, have become household names for many. And as we will discover, it is employing a surprising number of Catholics. One of them is Michael Knowles. Michael's a practicing Catholic who attends the Latin Mass. And this, of course, places him at a certain point on the spectrum of the ideological and cultural and theological wars upon which the future of the West may be thought to depend. I asked him for a conversation about the role of the Daily Wire and the growing influence of Catholicism within it, and for his take on the immediate future, both of the USA, the West, and the Catholic Church. And he joins me now. Michael Knowles, I've been a fan from some way off, and it's very nice to meet you in person. The Daily Wire is an extraordinary platform. You've been involved in it for about 8 years, I think. Can you begin by first of all telling us, for those people who on the wrong side of the Atlantic or the other side of the Atlantic who don't follow it, exactly what it does? Because it's tempting to say slightly unique or very unique or quite unique. One can't ever use an adjective, but it has a uniqueness all of its own. And then I'm going to ask you a bit about your own journey into the Catholic faith or back to the Catholic faith. But can you begin by telling us, for those who don't know it, what the Daily Wire is?
Certainly, and thank you so much for having me. It's a great honor to be here. I just moved my collection of Father Brown stories off of my desk, but I'm obviously a longtime fan, not only of the Herald, but of the many illustrious writers that have written for it. The Daily Wire does not have quite so long a history as the Catholic Herald. It began in Southern California about 9 or 10 years ago now. I'm in the strange position of having been friends with all of the people who started it before it existed. And so in those days, we were all working alternately in politics and show business. I had worked in both. To my great shame, I was once a professional actor in my wayward youth in plays in New York and films and TV and things like that. And I also have been involved in politics at a professional level since I was a teenager. So I was doing a bit of both those things. The founder of the Daily Wire, Jeremy Boring, is a film producer, film director, who also was running the super secret conservative showbiz group in Hollywood. So secret it had a Wikipedia page called Friends of Abe, as in Abraham Lincoln. Another one of the founding talent, Ben Shapiro, though he never worked in politics at the campaign level or show business, you know, directly, he was quite well known even 10 years ago. And he wrote a book about Hollywood exposing a lot of the left-wing bias there. He was pals with Jeremy and I guess really all of us in the FOA group. Andrew Clavin was another founding talent. He actually is a very successful Hollywood screenwriter and a novelist. I think Drew is about 155 years old. So he was there, you know, even before Hollywood existed. When they asked me to join very, very early on, I had the thought that one does not move to Hollywood to get a real job. You know, I sort of actually resisted the suggestion. And I thought, here's just another right-wing website. It'll probably disappear in 6 months. And my friend Jeremy said, Michael, don't be an idiot. You know, let me give you health insurance and you can help us launch this thing. I said, okay, why not? And then within 14 months, it became profitable. That was shocking to us. And within about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, it became the biggest new media company on the right. And now, as traditional broadcast has declined, I don't know, I suppose it would be one of the biggest institutions on the American right. A great surprise to all of us who were involved. But I suppose pertinent to our conversation, One thing that has made the Daily Wire unique, certainly has distinguished it from other right-wing groups in America, is that it would seem that we represent all the different strains of American conservatism. You could get 100 conservatives into a room. They would all find the one thing they disagree on. There are the traditionalists, the libertarians, the neoconservatives. I once heard the obscure political monikers described as the right-wing version of gender pronouns. And so at the Daily Wire, we have Jeremy is much more libertarian, has a touch of the Bush-era neoconservatism, perhaps. Ben was very libertarian for a lot of his public life, though he's kind of changed that a little bit. Andrew Klavan, much more focused on culture. I come from a much more traditionalist and Catholic strain of conservatism. Matt Walsh comes from the sledgehammer school of conservatism, where you just absolutely wallop your opponents on the head. So I think that, in a way, made the Daily Wire much more durable than some of the other outlets that crop up. Because, well, you know, if you marry yourself to the spirit of the age, you'll find yourself a widow in the next. And this is good advice, not only for the church, but for politics, because political moments come and go every, 5 years or so. So it launched. We're now in our 9th or 10th year, which is an eternity in political media. Who knows if we scheduled this interview next year, who knows if it would even exist anymore. But it's been a marvelous ride. And part of the reason that I think it has been able to grow so quickly is not only for the reasons I've just mentioned, the diversity of opinion, the embrace of more novel media strategies, but also that the Daily Wire did not merely want to comment on culture. We wanted to create culture. So we wanted to make feature films. We wanted to get laws changed. We wanted to lead political movements, and we've done all those things. We, during COVID, we sued the Biden administration to stop the private employer mandate for the vaccines. We launched with Matt Walsh the What Is a Woman movie that helped bring the confusion over what a man and a woman are to public fore. It tells you a lot about our present political confusion. And, you know, we've launched a film studio. We launched a children's company. We've recently launched a razor company to take on a woke razor company, a chocolate company to take on Hershey. We call ours She Her, Jeremy's Chocolates, you know, She Her and He Him. One of them has nuts, but I won't be so vulgar as to tell you which. And a cigar company called Mayflower Cigars, which is mine. So that's been a lot of fun. And we've been running 300 miles an hour since 2014. And we'll see. At a certain point, you know, maybe we'll trip. But in the meantime, it's been a great deal of fun.
I think it's quite extraordinary. People on our side of the Atlantic will be absolutely bemused at this, partly because we have the paradox, whereas you have a separation of church and state, and we have an infusion of church and state. And our infusion has left us completely politically paralysed, so that the thought of people setting out to do what you've done, forgetting just the right-wing platform, that's difficult enough in itself. But to add to it a zeal for campaigning laws and creating culture, it's a form of ambitious expansionism that just doesn't exist over here, I'm sorry to say. One of the things I've been really interested in, particularly watching Ben Shapiro manage some of the issues that come to him, is the way in which there's a degree of religious homogeneity that you don't see in other areas. You would think that an Orthodox Jew dealing with Catholics, and I guess there's some evangelicals in the mix somewhere in the company, but the capacity to take, if you like, a monotheistic cultural norm and commit to it with sufficient insight and flexibility, not only is it a very mature balancing act to pull off, but it's obviously very productive. Has this been worked out through a lot of hard negotiation behind doors, or is it simply almost, if you like, a natural reemergence of monotheistic siblingship in the face of a vandal counterculture?
There's been a lot of laughing and there's been a lot of yelling, but there have not been any hard negotiations, which I think is helpful. You point out that we've got our founding talent as an Orthodox Jew. Then we have Andrew Klavan, who no one even knows exactly what version of Christianity he is. It would probably be Anglo-Catholic, or, you know, some kind of high church Anglicanism with an infusion of some evangelical beliefs as well. And then I'm Catholic. Matt is Catholic, though some people, the way he talks, he sometimes talks like an evangelical too, so he gets a bit of crossover there.
That's right.
But sometimes people aren't quite sure. Occasionally people will ask me, Michael, how difficult is it to work for an Orthodox Jew? And I say, well, I actually don't work for an Orthodox Jew because Ben doesn't really manage the company. If he did, I would have been thrown out the window quite a long time ago. I said, it's much harder, the situation that I have. I don't have to work for a Jew. I have to work for Protestants. You know, the company was founded by three Protestants who have all sorts of diverse and eccentric views. And so you've got among the owners, mostly Protestants, one Jew, and they only ever seem to hire Catholics, which is a very strange turn of events. On top of that, a lot of the employees, talent, you know, on-screen talent, and also a lot of people who are behind the scenes running the business, have converted to Catholicism over the course of the company.
So this is very interesting. I'd like to pitch an idea at you. I mean, I didn't want to stop you, but this plays into something that I think is very exciting and very stimulating, and I'd like to test it out. So I'm a recent Catholic convert. But one of the conclusions I've come to as I look at history and try and interpret present circumstances, which are both shockingly clear and sometimes baffling as well, is that the only organization, the only entity that has the capacity to bring some weight and muscle to bear on this cultural revolution is the Catholic Church. If it fails, or if a kind of an internal schism or takeover debilitates it, we're in real trouble. I'm very interested to hear you're saying this multi-variegated religious organism you're part of is hiring Catholics. Do you share my view? I'm not asking you to share it as in, please join my club. I'm asking you to test the hypothesis to destruction. What's your view on the notion that essentially one of the reasons for hiring Catholics is that there's a composite mental, philosophical and spiritual homogeneity is not quite the right word, but integratedness that other spiritualities don't bring in quite the same way. This is not to say they're better or worse. It's simply to say that Catholicism is the heart, soul and mind of the West. It made the West. Is there in the hiring of Catholics by this variegated group of religious people a sense that actually that's where the muscle lies? Or is it just an accident and partly because Catholics are much more charming people than anybody else?
I've always attributed it to the masochism of the owners of the company, but I like your answer a little bit better, and there's quite a lot to it, because I say this in no false modesty, but in a spirit of true humility. There are many questions to which I do not know the answer, and I'm very grateful to be Catholic, because when a question pops up, be it on the nature of the Trinity or the ideal regime or what I ought to have for breakfast on Tuesday morning, I can look in the Summa Theologiae, and 99 times out of 100, I will get an answer, including about my breakfast. And when I don't find an answer in the Summa Theologiae on that rare occasion, I will have recourse to many other doctors of the church, fathers of the church, to the whole magisterium and deposit of faith. And this is not possible for other shades and sects of Christianity, and it's not really possible for other religious traditions. I remember one time I was in some kind of argument with Jeremy, who is just the most delightfully curious. He takes the faith very seriously. He holds probably some of the most heretical opinions one could possibly imagine, and he engages with all of them, you know. And so we were arguing about some point of doctrine or other, I don't know. And he was angry with another colleague of ours, and he said, "Yes, I brought this up, and you'll never believe what he told me." I said, "Well, what was the view that you were articulating?" And he said, "Well, the view that you know, and I'm not saying I hold this view, but that the Old Testament God is bad, and the New Testament God is good, and they're kind of distinct, and this, that, and the other thing." And I said, "Oh, yes, Marcionism." He said, "That's what he said. You Catholics, you have an answer for everything, and you know, you never think for yourself." And it was very funny. I mean, he was obviously laughing a bit about it as well. I couldn't come up with I couldn't come up with the Marcion heresy, and I couldn't come up with the refutations of the Marcion heresy on the spot. Same goes for Albigensianism, same goes for all of the other ones. And so there is a systematic aspect to the Catholic faith and theology, which is becoming more and more important. There have been periods in political history when the Catholic, we can afford to push Catholic thought off to the side. This is not one of them. To use just one pressing political example, the rise of the surrogacy industry and in vitro fertilization, particularly coupled with the radical redefinition of marriage, presents grave problems for our political order. And even some of the best-intentioned conservatives are coming up short to explain why these things are wrong. They might have an intuition of the wisdom of repugnance. They might have a sense that these things are wrong, but they can't quite explain why. Well, happily, the church can explain why. And but this requires going back through, I don't know, perhaps Humanae Vitae, perhaps through Catholic social teaching, perhaps much further back than that to the perennial teachings of the church. Alexis de Tocqueville, who's probably the best observer of American politics ever, and he was making his observations in the 19th century, in a less frequently quoted passage of Democracy in America, he said that Americans are very religious and it's a charming, wonderful thing, but their religion is a little bit incoherent. And so it's going to go one of two ways. Either America, which has such a Protestant aesthetic and facade to it, either they will follow their ideas to their logical conclusion and wind up Catholic, or they will follow some of their other ideas to their logical conclusion and give up religion altogether. And the swimming the Tiber that's going on at the Daily Wire, I think, is reflective of broader social trends in the Anglosphere and throughout the West. And it's a reminder of another quote by Hilaire Belloc. I have to take it as a matter of faith that the church is divinely instituted. But for those who doubt the divine institution, one proof of its divinity would be that no other institution conducted with such knavish imbecility would have lasted a fortnight.
Yes, that's right. Yes. But de Tocqueville was astonishingly prescient because, of course, that's exactly what's happening philosophically in the West. People, Protestantism, the spirit of the Reformation, the endless relativism and personalized reaction against the faith has led through Protestant schismatic variegations to ultimately to the new atheists and then to no belief, or, as you quite rightly say, to Catholicism. One of the things that's happened here is that a number of people have managed to evade the cancel culture as the journalists from the left move in and attempt to try and pin on them one of the fake phobias in order to denigrate them. The answers come back, well, don't ask me about gay marriage, ask the church. I'm just a Catholic. So you need to take it higher. And this has worked extremely well for one or two eccentric Catholics in public life on the right here in this country. But the problem we have, and I'd like to ask you about this almost more than anything else, is that whilst both de Tocqueville and Belloc and these politicians exercised quite a gravitational pull on me as I made my own way towards Catholicism, it was on the assumption that the magisterium wouldn't change, because that's what a magisterium is. And now I discover that the Pope has been pushing the COVID vaccine, which was contingent upon research made on an aborted fetus, that the optics, at any rate, of gay blessing bleed into the possibility of homosexual marriage, using therapeutic rather than theological or pneumatic criteria. And I'm one of those people who now says it's almost impossible to do evangelism as a Catholic, much though I'd like to, because the magisterium isn't holding the line anymore. What's your view of the civil war within the Catholic Church over the magisterium and the prospects for finding some form of solution that is less suicidal than what the rest of society has experienced?
I posed this question to a priest friend of mine some years ago, and he told me that our Lord gives us challenging pontificates sometimes to remind us that the Pope is fallible except when he's infallible, which is an important thing to remember. Obviously, we're speaking over audio here. If you could see right behind me, I have a little statue of Dante. And Dante also helps me to remember that we have challenging pontificates from time to time.
Yes, he places many of the popes in fairly noxious places.
Poor Boniface VIII did not fare very well in Inferno. And Boniface VIII also does not fare very well in Dante's work of political philosophy in Monarchy. And so to give a sense of the turbulent feelings of the moment throughout the history of the church that somehow get smoothed out over time, in Monarchy, Dante explicitly contradicts Boniface VIII's papal bull, Unum Sanctam, which posits that the temporal authority is subservient to the papal authority. And he grounds this on the theory of the sun and the moon, that the spiritual power is the sun and the temporal power is the moon, and the moon has no power in itself. It only reflects the light of the sun. And Dante, through a long Aristotelian syllogism, says, this is bogus. He's clearly happier than ever that he put poor Boniface in hell. And immediately after Dante's death, this was probably the last work that Dante published or that he wrote. After his death, there is some debate over this work. But again, we're talking about the early 14th century here. 200 years later, in the 16th century, the work is placed on the index. So you have Dante, the divine poet, has his work of political philosophy thrown on the index, and it's prohibited for Catholics to read it. Now, right around this time, you'll recall, there was a little something called the Protestant Revolution, and so one can understand why a challenge to papal authority might wind up on the index. Then, fast forward 300 years, the book finds itself taken off of the index. This is in the 19th century. What's going on in the 19th century of the rise of political liberalism, a challenge even to the temporal authority and to the monarchy. And so one can understand why it might fall off. And then fast forward to the pontificate of Benedict XV, who says that in celebration of Dante, that this is a man who has perfectly throughout his entire life articulated the Catholic faith. What is one to do with that? I suppose things are smoothed out over time, and happily the Holy Spirit never departs from the church. But I'm sure in the moment, in the 13th and 14th centuries, this was unpleasant. And for the 300 years that the divine poet's work was on the index, it was probably a bit unpleasant. And so, hypothetically speaking, if a pope were to come out and contradict two millennia of church teaching on the legitimacy of capital punishment. I'm just, pulling a hypothetical.
An idea from absolutely nowhere. Yes, absolutely. Shooting the breeze philosophically. Should that happen? Yes.
This would be something that really could not happen. I attend the traditional Latin Mass. I am quite a fan. My confirmation name is Thomas. I'm quite a fan of the Scholastics and the wonderful traditions of the Church. So I'm troubled by some of the confusions that have been brought about by modernity. And yet, the Church is the only institution that has made it. It's the only one that has survived from antiquity. It is, as you say, the institution that has shaped and animated our entire civilization. And to quote Alexander Pope, all nature is but art unknown to thee, all chance direction which thou canst not see. Nothing will happen outside of the scope of providence, which might in God's passive will feel very unpleasant at the time. But our Lord promises us that he will never leave the church. And so when a pontificate makes one reach for one's hair to pull it out and start screaming, We kiss it up to God, and we remember that suffering is indeed sanctifying.
That's very helpful, and it fits in with an image that I've been trying to help some of my friends with as they've been dealing with this, which I had a sense that the magisterium is a bit like a meandering stream, which as it makes its way to the sea, moves left and then right and then left and then right, but always closer to the sea. And if you concentrate on its lateral movement, it would freak you out a bit. But if you concentrate on its getting to its destination, it's less worrying. I think one of the reasons for worrying is that we seem to live in a time of ideological intensity, which I guess has been brought about by social media and the internet. I mean, in previous generations, some of these ideas would have taken longer to percolate through. You'd have had to build coffee houses and have some bourgeois people with time on their hands to chat about it. And, you know, through the length of time that these things would take, there'd be maybe less frenetic and less extreme. But we've condensed communication down into such a sort of an immediate hit that it's really quite difficult to take that longer perspective. So do you think it's just a matter of not panicking and that inevitably there's going to be a great deal of rolling around, the loss of balance, but nonetheless, so long as we avoid the self-inflicted apocalypse, things will come right in the end, thin Pope, fat Pope kind of thing?
I think so, though I don't want this to lead us to a kind of political or ecclesiastical quietism. There's an irony that after the Second Vatican Council, we heard calls for more active participation of the laity in the liturgy and the affairs of the church. And yet, whenever we actively participate in ways that contradict the desires of a 1970s generation that is enamored of novelty and relativism, then we see a quick return of clericalism. Then we see the laity have to sit down and be quiet and, you know, do as they're told. So we ought to, you know, keep calm and carry on, to borrow a phrase from your neck of the woods. One example of this might be, I mentioned the traditional Latin Mass earlier, and there was a troubling motu proprio that came out recently, the Traditiones Custodes, which seemed...
I think I've heard
of
it.
You might have come across your desk. It seemed to express a hostility toward the Mass of the Ages, which was almost entirely in place by the time of Gregory the Great and shaped... virtually all of the saints in the history of the church, and to which many people still have a great deal of affection, and which also happens to bring a lot of young people back into the church, and many converts and reverts are drawn to it. And I could go on and on talking about the beauty and virtues of the traditional Mass. That said, who am I to question things? I'm merely a lay person. But we do have canon law, and we do have the magisterium. And we do have lots of bishops who are princes of the church. And we do have certain orders that are devoted to the traditional Latin Mass. And we have a way of preserving things. So I think a lot of people's reaction to Traditiones Custodes was to yell and scream and pull their hair out. But my friends... and the trad trads, you know, that I know, they did not, because we do recognize that within Providence all will unfold as it ought to, and we simply cooperate with God's grace, and we try to do the right thing, and we try to do good and avoid evil. And in my experience, many of us have been able to continue to worship in a way that we consider reverent and in keeping with two millennia of church history. And frankly, if you asked me on the future of the liturgy, I would say that it's quite clear at this point that the future of the liturgy will be the traditional Latin Mass or something very close to it. I think that the sappy hymns of the 1970s, which weren't even cool back 50 years ago, they don't have a lot of staying power, and Gregorian chant certainly does.
I'm sure that's true. I'd like to consult your political antennae precisely about bishops. And so we ought indeed to speak of them with respect and affection, particularly given the responsibilities they have. On our side of the water, we have a particularly unusual historical precedent, so that one of the reasons why Catholic bishops and indeed Catholic laity have been fairly quiet is because the establishment has been so universally Anglican and set against the Catholic Church, with punitive laws until fairly recently, a century or so ago. But behind all that, there's been a kind of snobbery of the establishment, which looked at Catholics as, well, on the one hand, half a dozen ancient aristos with lands, but mainly Italians, Poles, and other people whose hygiene and culinary habits were not quite English. And so there was a dreadful sense of snobbery. And it seems to me now that I've converted and I've changed teams, always a dangerous thing to do. I want to encourage the Catholics in England and say you don't need to be affected by this snobbery. It's without any kind of virtue at all. But everything else, de Tocqueville style again, has evaporated. And if you don't take up the middle ground to recreate culture, to challenge the bad laws, nobody's going to do it. And what's more, it's your responsibility. So I let the bishops off the hook to some extent, because I think the weight of evolutionary culture over the last 50 years has been hard to bear. And to suddenly say, well, actually, all those cathedrals, all those parish churches, all the paraphernalia of the Catholic architectural and sacramental mind that has contoured our society, you know, we need to remarry again after this temporary divorce. But that's going to take really quite a lot of courage and renewal. But in America, do you think that the reason that the bishops have been fairly quiet, by and large, in the face of the discomfort that some of the recent changes from the Vatican have produced is precisely because if they can see through the present temporality of this regime, then by avoiding being politically executed or marginalized or sent to the stocks or whatever the ecclesiastical equivalent of that happens to be, there's a job to be done when the atmosphere changes. Do you think it's actually a virtue that the bishops are holding their peace because they sense that the tide will change and they want to be there when it does? Or do they, like so many other people, feel demoralized, unsupported, bearing burdens of institutional responsibility given the child abuse and other problematic phenomena that are really quite difficult to work their way through? How do you understand the present sense of passivity? It's as an enforced quietism that's sensible and brave, or as people have had the stuffing knocked out of them?
Well, you'd have to ask me bishop by bishop, I suppose, which probably would be impolite to do, but I think it's a mixed bag, because we're called to be wise as serpents and innocent as doves, and I think some of the bishops have done that. And I think there's a quite a bit of evidence that they've done that, that they have protected the faithful in the tradition of the church and the magisterium in a quiet way that doesn't attract a lot of publicity, but actually that's one of the strengths of it. And there have been some who have behaved in a cowardly way. Some years ago, I published a fake book called Reasons to Vote for Democrats, a Comprehensive Guide, and it had totally blank pages.
Yes. I just read about that. Superb bestseller, yes.
So probably my magnum opus. It's hard to outdo it. So I gave a copy to a priest friend of mine, and he said, Michael, this is a great idea, and I think I'm going to do my own version, and I'll call it The Wisdom of the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops, a Comprehensive Guide.
And, superb. And, very good.
Though I'm somewhat hopeful, not only because it's a theological virtue and a demand, but also by the way that the bishops have reacted recently. On Twitter, the USCCB published some question about, I think it may have been about the liturgy, and I noticed a lot of people made fun of the felt banners that became ubiquitous after the reforms following Vatican II. And the USCCB account itself responded and said, nobody liked the felt banners. You know, they're gone. It was kind of an admission. And you see this. I harp on the liturgy so much, not only because lex orandi, lex credendi, but also because it's so visual. You know, one really has a picture of it. And when I was growing up, it was all these sappy 1970s hymns that were just I don't know how women could sing them. Certainly no men could really sing them with a straight face. And it was all just sentimental piffle. But now you see the reintroduction of chanting, of some sturdy hymns, of Latin, of Greek, of Ad Orientem, celebration of the Mass in some cases. And that's not just coming out of the Fraternity of St. Peter or the Institute of Christ the King. This is coming out of the diocese, and this is coming from bishops who might be considered somewhat moderate or even somewhat liberal. I was gratified to see the other day on CBS Face the Nation, Wilton Cardinal Gregory, the cardinal in Washington, D.C., was asked about our supposedly Catholic president, Joe Biden, and his flagrant and persistent denial of very important Catholic teachings. And Cardinal Gregory, who has a reputation as being a liberal prelate, came out and he said that the president might be sincere in his faith, but he's a cafeteria Catholic who picks and chooses what he wants to believe in and ignores the challenging teachings. And I thought, you know, good for you, Your Eminence. That's wonderful to see. Yes. And it was
that's quite severe. Yes.
Exactly. And a lot of because America is a little blunter in our use of language, there were many conservatives who thought that he was being timid and restrained. And I thought, no, that, you know, that cafeteria Catholic, that them's fighting words. And this is the cardinal speaking about the president of the United States. And so I greatly appreciated that. There was an Episcopalian priestess or bishopress or something on the panel who immediately came to the president's defense and misquoted St. Thomas Aquinas. And she was the only one on TV, you know, who was making the veins in my neck bulge. Even for a liberal prelate, he was not. He was defending the faith in a way probably that he felt was prudent and tactful, but nevertheless clear. So if it's not merely the prominent right-wing bishops who are doing this, but even some of the liberal ones, I think you're seeing a little bit of a sea change. And, you know, the church measures time not in days and weeks, but in centuries. And I think the confusion of the cultural revolutions is finally being corrected. 50 years too late for some people, but better late than never.
I'd like to try another couple of ideas on you, since, as you say, in your crossover years between an actor and a politician, you did a lot of Machiavelli. So you come particularly well informed to the present debate. Those of us in Europe look at what's happening in terms of the enormous immigration. You've also got mass immigration with the lack on the southern border of a different proportion. But many of us are saying that we're fighting Marx if we can make Marx responsible for cultural Marxism and progressive leftism. And we're losing very badly, and we're having freedom of speech taken away from us by use of all the phobia words, and public censorship has now reached levels that one wouldn't have thought possible. But that about 10 years later, Islam will begin to flex its muscles simply because the numbers that are there, and this isn't mere hysteria. This spring, for example, saw another example of the endless round of minute, annoying cancellations of Christian culture, Easter eggs, hot cross buns. But for the first time, some very glamorous Ramadan lights in Oxford Street, the centre of London's cultural life. And so those of us who see the balance of the fulcrum shifting do so with a certain amount of evidence to back it up. It's hard to know how the Catholic Church can defend Europe in the face of these two very powerful opponents. The American situation, is, as so often, is both the same and very different. What do you see politically happening, and what is the relationship of the Christian faith and the Catholic Church to what you see politically happening as the next electoral earthquake approaches and the chasm between the two sides looks ever more threatening, violent, and impossible to negotiate with any level of civility, let alone communication?
We are a bit luckier here in that our mass migration problem involves criminal cartels, yes, but largely Catholic peasants from Latin America, whereas your mass migration problem involves largely jihadis. So I would certainly take the Guatemalan economic migrants.
So same criminal cartels, but different product. I agree.
That's right. That's right. And a lot of confusion, unfortunately, coming out of the church and affiliated church institutions. It's no secret that Catholic Charities, the bishops, are largely behind facilitating mass migration into the United States. I take a charitable view, I think, of their intentions, in the same way that Chesterton might, which is, in Chesterton's observation, that heresy is often not the promotion of vice over virtue, but the promotion of one virtue to the exclusion of all the other virtues, which probably is what we're seeing here.
Very good. Spot on, as you saw from Wallace.
In this case, I suppose what I would ask the Catholic organizations and the prelates who are supportive of mass migration, I would ask them if Charles Martel ought to have supported mass migration at the Battle of Poitiers, now called the Battle of Tours. Should the Holy League have supported mass migration at Lepanto? Jan Sobieski, how closed-minded and narrow was he when he did not support mass migration at the Battle of Vienna? We're talking about, in the case of Europe, precisely the same people, the only difference being that now Europe is flinging open the gates. This is because of a grave misunderstanding of charity. And so the N-word crops up.
And also a great misunderstanding of Islam, but both together.
Yes, correct. It's amazing that the church has about a 1,400-year history of conflict with Islam. And perhaps it's not that we've forgotten what Islam is. It's that we've lost touch with our own faith and our own history. So that's what's caused us to lose sense of it. And as a consequence of this, of losing courage and a sense of identity, you see the N-word pop up. In America, we have an N-word that you're not allowed to say. And I think actually the N-word in Europe is probably even more taboo. And that word would be nationalism. One is not allowed to mention the nation. And nationalism has a strange connection to the Catholic faith because modern nationalism is a consequence of the Treaty of Augsburg and the Peace of Westphalia, which is when the Catholics lost to the Protestants. So in many ways, modern nation states are a product of conceding the political order to Protestantism. And yet, there's a little something good in them in the sense that love of country is not only not wrong, it's a very good thing. It's an extension of filial piety. It's quite disordered for you to oppose your own country. It's quite disordered to prefer someone else's country to your own country, just as it's quite disordered to prefer someone else's family to your own family. We are called to love and to charity, and there is an order to charity. I ought to love my children more than I love my neighbor down the street. I like him very much too, but I really have a responsibility for my children and they're very close to me. A political campaign that would change the way that the left has framed this issue would be very helpful because we're told now that to care at all for your own country and your own history and your own borders and your own people is hateful, hateful toward other people. But of course, it's not. It's a question of love and how love is best expressed, especially in America, because there is a myth about our country, which has a lot of truth to it, but it is a myth nevertheless, that America is the land of opportunity, totally open to everyone. You can show up here penniless and become a zillionaire, become an astronaut. Your kid could become president of the United States. Sure, that's true, but America was founded to be a shining city on a hill. Those are the words of Governor Winthrop, the Puritan governor of Massachusetts. This was supposed to be a model of Christian charity, and if the salt loses its savor, it's good for nothing and ought to be trodden underfoot. If America concedes her strength, her vitality, her very identity, then she's good for nothing. Good for nothing to us, the Americans. But even if your chief concern are the people who want to come here, good for nothing to them either.
But she does look as though she's conceding to some extent, unless there's a form of ideological renewal, not from the left. I hesitate to say from the right, because you'll be much better at this than I am. But I've always thought that the right is not a thing in of itself. Any more than conserving is an event of itself, but it's more a rebuke or a resistance or a negotiation with the utopian aspiration of the left. Is there going to be some form of renewal of vision, presumably Christian? What else is there to conserve from in America? I mean, and And if I can add, throw something else in, what's your view of the next election? Because rather like the next conclave, both the next American election and the next Vatican conclave are both going to have very serious consequences for what takes place in our civilization next.
Well, in both cases, the renewal will come about in large part because of a re-embrace of the Catholic faith. And if we don't do that, then there won't be any renewal. It seems silly that one would have to say that when it comes to the conclave, but I think probably we do, actually. And we have to say it when it comes to America as well, because while America is has long viewed herself as a Protestant nation, that would not even be possible. By which I mean the civilization was Catholic uniformly for the first 1,500 years. Then you have 200 or so years where there are kind of newer Protestant and then liberal ideas that crop up. But that's still a lot of time. I mean, you know, most of the formation, most of the ideas, most of the habits and attitudes and institutions that crop up have that Catholic DNA to them. Even if you look at the American form of government, now the left loves to call it a democracy, our sacred democracy. It's not quite that. Actually, the best description, the nearest description I've seen to the American form of government comes from the Summa Theologiae. I don't think I'm stretching too far to observe that when St. Thomas Aquinas is asked the ideal regime, he says, well, it's going to be a monarchy with a strong aristocratic element, with a strong representation for the people as well. And in America, we have a monarchical element, that's called the executive. We have an aristocratic element, which is not only seen in the legislature, the U.S. Senate, but also in the original preservation of the rights of the states to share in the federal power. And then obviously a representation for the people as well. That's Catholic. And whether that's because the framers of our Constitution were reading St. Thomas Aquinas or because they were reading his ideas mediated through intervening philosophers, those are pretty Catholic ideas. And I think it is noteworthy that the leaders of the American conservative movement, such as it has been for the last 70 years, have been disproportionately Catholic. I'm thinking, of course, of William F. Buckley Jr., who's largely credited with kicking the thing off, Russell Kirk, alternately considered the founder of the movement, Phyllis Schlafly, the most important woman in the movement ever. The list goes on and on. There are a lot of Catholics. And now today, the Catholic renewal in America, and I think in Europe and the UK, is largely Catholic because, to your point, the right does not really seem to have much existence in itself. You know, the term comes from the National Assembly during the French Revolution. The left are the people that are doing things, and the right, the monarchists and the Catholics, are saying, hey, please just don't chop our heads off. Thank you very much. We'd like to, you know, keep our property and our families. So that's not the most active kind of movement. The new ideas that are cropping up, the non-liberal ideas that are returning in American public life are coming from Catholic thinkers. I mean, even the term common good, there are a number of supposed right-wingers in America who shudder at that term because it sounds vaguely communist or socialist or something. But it need not be. It's a recognition that man is not an individual floating in outer space. That's a liberal idea, actually. Man is a social creature. Man is a political animal. And the family is the fundamental unit of society, not the individual. These are conservative ideas. The liberals are the ones trying to destroy the family. Often it's the conservatives who acquiesce to that. Another great line from Chesterton. He says the liberals are the progressives are the ones who go about messing things up, and the conservatives are the ones who make sure they never get fixed. Well, that very accurately describes the situation in America. But when you come to the Catholic thinkers and politicians, there's not merely a reaction here. In fact, liberalism is a reaction against Catholicism. So there's something a little sturdier. There are ideas and behaviors and practices that we can draw on. And I don't want to seem like I'm evading the question here. I'm really not. But we also have recourse to prayer in the fullness of truth. We often turn to prayer as a last resort. I guess it's just human nature. But prayer really ought to be a first resort. And even at the moments in history, I just mentioned the three biggies when it comes to Western history, Poitiers, Lepanto, and Vienna, things looked very, very bleak. And then we pray our rosary, we kiss it up to God, and things turn around. So if they do turn around, they'll turn around because we re-embrace the faith that built our civilization. As Cardinal Manning points out, all political conflict ultimately is theological. Or if we just continue to conserve the liberalism of 18 months ago, then, well, what American right is there even to win?
Michael, to bring us back to both the power of the rosary and the power of the mass is a great way to finish our conversation. So thank you. Thank you so much for the tour de force that you've offered. Thank you for all the political and spiritual wisdom that you've brought to conversation too. It's been really wonderful to talk to you, and I hope very much that the Daily Wire doesn't burn itself out in a fit of over-creativity in the next year or two, but actually continues to fill the vacuum with the wisdom of the Catholics that they go on hiring. Thank you very much for taking the time. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me. The pleasure has been all mine.